Since the dawn of civilization, spies of every nation and culture have worked to infiltrate their adversaries and glean the information that will give their side the advantage. The stakes are sky high, the strategies varied and imaginative, and the ultimate sign of success is that no one ever even knew you were there. In each episode, we will explore the moral and ethical gray zones of espionage, where treachery and betrayal go hand in hand with cunning and courage. This is the Spycraft 101 podcast. Welcome to your clandestine classroom. This is episode number 129 of the Spycraft 101 podcast. I'm here with Dr. Paul Winter. Paul is an independent historian, an author who specializes in wartime intelligence and military history, and a Red Team consultant. He's published articles in several journals, including Intelligence and National Security and War in History, and has written two books about World War II called D-Day Documents and Defeating Hitler, as well as a third book called First In, Last Out, The Post-War Organization, Employment, and Training of Royal Marines Commandos. He has also been an affiliated academic with the British Royal Marines, assisting with professional military education and officer career development, and was a member of the Land and Littoral Strike Team at the Maritime Warfare Center in Portsmouth in the United Kingdom. I invited Paul onto the podcast today to discuss a subject I've been wanting to learn more about right from the start, and one that he has previously taught a course on. I'm referring to the Cambridge Five, arguably the most famous spy ring of the Cold War. They were a group of men who did an astonishing amount of damage to British intelligence and the Foreign Office, and all of them were recruited while studying at Cambridge University in their youth. But before we dive into this story, I want to say a big thank you to everyone listening who is also supporting me on Patreon, including Robert T. and Cole M. Your monthly contributions there help me keep this podcast going week in and week out. As a way of thanking my patrons, I offer a lot of great freebies and promotions, including free and discounted books and products from the Spycraft 101 store. Patrons also get exclusive access to long-form articles of mine that aren't available anywhere else. If you haven't signed up for my Patreon yet, but you want to, you just click the link in the show notes on whatever podcast platform you're listening to right now. Paul, thank you for taking the time to talk to me today.
Thank you.
We've been in contact for months, as you know, so I'm glad that the opportunity finally presented itself for us to have this discussion, because I find that these are always worth the wait.
Exactly. Thank you.
So the Cambridge Five, they have come up in, to one degree or another, in several of my previous episodes, because you can't really talk about World War II and the Cold War without getting around to them eventually. But I haven't done an entire episode about them, and so I am very, very glad for this opportunity to talk about them with you now. So can you tell me exactly who those five members of the Cambridge Ring were?
Well, the Cambridge Five consisted of Kim Philby, Anthony Blunt, Guy Burgess, Donald MacLean, and John Cairncross.
So they're called Cambridge for a reason, obviously. Can you talk about how they were initially spotted and recruited and who did that? They were all very young, impressionable men at the time, I take it.
Indeed. Their recruitment is complex, convoluted, and far from clear. But what we do know is that following his anti-right-wing activities in Vienna, where he came to the attention of Soviet intelligence, Philby was recruited in 1934 by Arnold Deutsch, a Soviet illegal and notable talent spotter. Philby's recruitment originated from Deutsch having met Litzy Friedman, Philby's first wife, who then introduced the two men with dire consequences for the British secret state. In turn, Philby introduced Deutsch to MacLean and Burgess, whom he recruited in 1934 and 1935, respectively. Philby also supplied Deutsch with the names of other potential Cambridge recruits. Confusion rests over how Blunt was recruited. One of his biographers states he was recruited in 1937, having been introduced to Deutsch by Burgess. Another states that he was recruited in 1934 and went straight on to talent spot Burgess, Philby, MacLean, Cairncross, and Michael Strait. Cairncross, however, was recruited by the Soviet agent James Klugman in 1936, after his time at Cambridge.
Okay, you mentioned that there were other potential recruits as well, so there could have been a lot more than five if some of those recruitment pitches had worked out, I take it?
Indeed, and we'll sort of go on to that a bit later. But in terms of what were their motivations, I mean, sort of before answering that question, it is vital to establish the historical context in which the five were recruited. The interwar period was characterized by opposing totalitarian ideologies, the radicalization of the masses, the general strike of 1926 in the UK, the Wall Street crash of 1929, the Great Depression, the hunger marches and polarization of UK domestic politics. Unsurprisingly, this dramatic background had an effect on the mindsets of those British citizens who were recruited to spy for the Soviets. Yet their true motivations are still hard to ascertain after all these decades. There is still much debate, controversy, and uncertainty as to their motivations, but there were some general factors we do need to know about. First, they were against the sexual mores of the day regarding homosexuality and sexual promiscuity. 2.5 of the five were homosexual, and the other 2.5 were heterosexual. That was Donald MacLean being bisexual. Second, they were fighting against their own class, upbringing, and privilege. Philby, Blunt, Burgess, and MacLean were all public, ex-public schoolboys from relatively well-off backgrounds. Interestingly, Cairncross, however, was the odd man out. He came from a modest background, didn't go to public school, and had first been enrolled at Glasgow University. Third, they were rebellious and hated capitalism and the British class system. They believed that the Soviet Union was a bulwark against fascism and Nazism, that the Western democracies were soft on the right wing and were appeasing Hitler, Mussolini, and later Franco. Although they were naive to believe, like so many did in the interwar period, that the Soviet Union was some sort of utopia, they nevertheless believed that communism was an antidote to the world's problems. They all possessed a touch of student naivety and arrogance about how the real world operated. They thought that they knew better than their elders on these matters. Also, lastly, it cannot be underestimated how much of a childish excitement played its part in the work of the five. The possession of secrets, being different, evading surveillance, deceiving people, the thrill of being part of the secret world.
So these guys, they all attended Cambridge around the same time period, obviously. Were they in the same social circle outside of the actual spy ring? I mean, were they all friends to begin with, or did these relationships kind of develop through the recruitment?
Well, interestingly, Philby, Blunt, Burgess, and Cairncross all went to Trinity College, Cambridge, but Donald MacLean was at Trinity Hall College. Philby and Blunt were the linchpins in holding this network together. They kept tabs on each individual and looked out for them. Yet again, Cairncross was the lone wolf because he operated on his own, even though he knew Blunt from Cambridge, Burgess socially, MacLean from his job in the Foreign Office, and Philby from his service in MI6.
Okay, so some loose kind of connections there that developed along the way.
Indeed.
So because we keep going back to Cambridge, what was it in particular about this school that made it such a fertile ground for recruitment in a way that I guess none of the others are quite as known for during that time period, at least?
Well, historically, Cambridge has always been more left-leaning than Oxford. So consequently, it's always been a benign operating environment for Soviet talent spotters and provided good cover for those with left-wing stroke communist sympathies. Some of these communist sympathizers or fellow travelers were university tutors. One such figure was Maurice Dobb, a history fellow at Pembroke College, Cambridge, and a Communist Party member, who encouraged Philby to go to Europe and work with the communists. He was also a great influence on Burgess, Blunt, MacLean, and James Klugman. As an elite ancient university, Cambridge was a natural feeder of talent into the civil service, intelligence and security services, UK politics, law, the BBC, and journalism. However, the Cambridge Apostles is the key to understanding the Cambridge spy network. The Apostles were first formed in 1820 as an intellectual society where academic subjects could be discussed. By the interwar period, however, it had become heavily influenced by communist and fellow traveller academics who converted young impressionable undergraduates to socialism and communism. In essence, these dons knowingly or unknowingly primed suitable undergraduates for Soviet talent spotters. Notably, Blunt, Burgess, Cairncross, and Leo Long were all apostles. Finally, geographically, Cambridge being just 60 miles away from London was obviously an obvious focal point for Soviet espionage.
So would you say then that it's obviously, like you said, a real focal point for a number of reasons, but were they also actively recruiting on a lot of other campuses around England at that same time, you think, just with perhaps less success?
Well, interestingly, there's a clue to this because Arnold Deutsch had initially been to University College London to study as a student, and that post provided him the perfect cover from where he could talent spot the brightest students at other UK universities. Nigel West, the intelligence expert, has also talked about an Oxford spy network, but to date, there is little substantiated evidence of this existence. However, Oxbridge also dominated British intellectual and political life and was therefore an obvious intelligence target for the Soviets. As I've already stated, it was where the establishment drew the vast majority of its raw recruits.
So once these guys left Cambridge, they spread out mostly. I mean, I know that you mentioned that Philby obviously went into an intelligence role. Where did all of their individual careers take them after that?
Right. Philby initially started out as a journalist on the London Times, but desperate to get into the British secret state, he eventually joined wartime SOE and then MI6. He then carried on into the post-war period as head of MI6's anti-Soviet cell, Section 9, and then became UK intelligence liaison officer in Washington. He was even tipped as a possible successor to C, the chief of MI6, at this time Major General Sir Stuart Minges. Graduating from Cambridge, Blunt became an academic in the history of art. He went on to become a wartime MI5 officer and then surveyor of the King's and then Queen's pictures. Burgess was a pre-war BBC producer and journalist, but worked in the early years of the war for MI5 and MI6. He finally ended up in the Foreign Office, where one of his jobs was private secretary to Hector McNeill, the deputy to the ardent anti-communist Foreign Secretary Ernest Bevin. Donald MacLean, however, was a high flyer and went straight into the Foreign Office in 1934, staying there until 1951. During his career, he worked in London in the Western Department of the Foreign Office, was third secretary at the British Embassy in Paris, second and first secretaries at the British Embassy in Washington, the head of the Chancery at the British Embassy in Cairo, and then head of the American Department at the Foreign Office in London. Cairncross joined the pre-war civil service, working in the Foreign Office, the Treasury, and then the Cabinet Office. During the war, he sat on the Maud Committee and was thus involved with the Tube Alloys project, the UK's atomic weapons programme. He later joined the Government Code and Cipher School at Bletchley Park as an intelligence analyst and was later posted to Section 5, the counterintelligence cell of MI6. Post-war, Cairncross stayed in the civil service and worked for the Ministry of Supply before being forced to resign over his connections with Burgess. It is interesting to note that actually it was the Second World War which acted as a catalyst for Philby, Blunt and Burgess in terms of their joining the secret world. This was because the intelligence and security services expanded rapidly in order to wage war against Nazi Germany and the Axis powers. Consequently, lots of civilians were conscripted into the British secret world for hostilities-only service. Crucially, if it hadn't been for the war, Philby, Burgess and Blunt may never have had the opportunity to penetrate British intelligence.
So actually, I want to follow up on something you mentioned about Blunt a moment ago. I know that you said his position was surveyor of the King's pictures at one point,
yes.
And that's a very unusual and almost confusing title or position for me. So was there any intelligence value in the work that he did, or did it just give him access to the King's court and a lot of extremely influential and important people?
Well, I think there is debate over whether Blunt was still in contact with the Soviets. He always denied it after the war, but we there's a lot of smoke and mirrors about this, so we don't have any hard and fast evidence. I mean, the Soviets would have been happy that he was in such a position, but in terms of gathering real secrets, it would have been of minimal opportunities. I think there is a suggestion that after at the end of the war, Blunt was doing some interesting work for the royal family, getting back sensitive papers, a lot about Edward VIII from Nazi Germany and his connection with the Nazis, and that somehow, you know, he did. Blunt definitely went out to Germany to reclaim property of the royal family, but it strongly suggested that these were very sensitive papers and that he did such a good job for the royal family that he was therefore given this immensely privileged job in Buckingham Palace.
Okay, that makes sense to me, certainly. I'd always thought that of him as a little bit of an odd man out, in that sense compared to the other four in the ring, because that position, I just could not figure out what was the great value in that position other than the access to the family, which of course is inherently very valuable. So since we're talking about these guys as a whole, what were some of the other access that they had that they were able to pass along to the Soviets in the 30s and 40s and on?
Well, it's a dazzling array of intelligence. Atomic secrets pertaining to tube alloys and the Manhattan projects, SIS operations and CX material, information on the Joint Intelligence Committee and Double Cross Committee work, the identities of serving British intelligence officers, tradecraft, standard operating procedures, locations of MI6 stations and substations, political gossip, Cabinet Office material, Foreign Office reports, MI5 operations, as well as the ultra-secret and Enigma decrypts. In the post-war period, McLean, Burgess and Philby supplied information on the Korean War, NATO, Cold War planning, US intelligence and SIS networks behind the Iron Curtain. Ironically, the five produced so much material that Stalin and Soviet intelligence became convinced they were triple agents passing them disinformation. Yet in reality, these spies hoovered up any secret material that came into their possession, making them highly productive moles.
My gosh, that's absolutely incredible that it's too good to be true, even from your handlers. They're thinking there's got to be another level to this entire thing, even though they're the ones pulling the strings to begin with. And it's just that the British counterintelligence was just oblivious, I guess.
Well, indeed. And basically, it just fueled Stalinist paranoia that they thought that these men were too good to be true. And they were, as I said, probably triple agents.
Oh, right. Well, nobody does paranoia better than Stalin and his people in that time period.
Yeah, exactly.
That makes sense. So they were able to pass this along. Has there been like an effective damage assessment of just how these leaks actually hurt British statehood or British government along the way?
Well, good, very good question. Despite supplying so much intelligence material to Moscow, this is very hard to actually assess. I mean, aside from reputational damage to the British secret state, the Cambridge spies helped ensure the Soviets detonated their first atomic bomb 2 to 3 years before the JIC assessed they would be in a position to do so. Major SIS operations were blown and undermined. Hundreds of agents behind the Iron Curtain were caught and killed owing to Philby's treachery in particular. Right. I mean, the five also created divisions, paranoia, suspicion, and paralysis within the British secret state. I mean, there was basically a witch hunt ensued with figures such as Victor Rothschild and Guy Liddell from MI5 being suspected of being Soviet agents. Mm. I mean, this in turn diverted some of the UK's counterintelligence effort away from the Soviets and placed it on internal employees. Although a what-if of history, if you like, the treachery of the Magnificent Five could easily have been blown the ultra-secret due to German penetration of the Soviet Union, this would have had serious consequences for the Allied war effort. It has been argued that the role of ultra-intelligence shortened the war by at least 2 years. Mm. The Cambridge spies also sowed suspicion and distrust between the CIA, FBI, National Security Agency, MI6, MI5, and GCHQ, and temporarily damaged the Anglo-American special relationship in intelligence and security matters. And the unmasking of Philby, Burgess, and McLean would undoubtedly have damaged agent recruitment at the time. I mean, frankly, how could would-be agents for the West trust US-UK intelligence if it were heavily penetrated by the Soviets?
Right. That makes sense. And I know that we being the West and the NATO powers, found the Soviet Union to be very just opaque for such a long period of time. And I guess a lot of that was due to the effectiveness of these guys. If hundreds of our agents behind the Iron Curtain were getting swept up and interrogated and killed, then that would really, really hurt our ability to see into the country other than from some of our like high-flying reconnaissance flights and that sort of thing. And that's a very myopic way of looking at a country.
Oh, yeah, sure. But also, I think, ironically, it was mirroring that Stalinist paranoia that, again, there was the five created such paranoia in Washington and London, and then within NATO, that, again, everyone was sort of chasing their tails and looking over their shoulders. So, you know, without that big list of material that the five passed on, they, just by their existence and then the discovery that they'd been spying for the Soviets, that in itself had a huge exponential impact on Western defense.
Right, right. Yeah, certainly. I do recall from a previous interview that I've done, we focused primarily on James Angleton at the CIA and yes. his relationship with Philby. I got the impression he never recovered from Philby's betrayal, and he kind of took it out on the employees of the CIA. You know, his paranoia ramped up because if, you know, one of my closest friends can be a Soviet agent, then anybody could be. And so Philby's effect was very long lasting even over here in the US.
Oh, definitely. And also that paranoia from James Jesus Angleton was then fueled by Peter Wright. Then it was, the attention was away from the Cambridge spies, and then it started to come on to people, as I said, like Victor Rothschild and Guy Liddell. But then people like Sir Roger Hollis, who was a very senior officer in MI5, who then later became Director General, and people like Peter Wright never let Hollis off the hook and kept saying that he or someone very high up in MI5 must have been a Soviet agent. But then saying that, it's quite interesting, the whole Agent Sonia saga was the fact that Agent Sonia was cycling from Oxford to Blenheim Palace during the war. And as you know, Blenheim Palace was the later wartime headquarters of MI5. Mm. And she was picking up dead letter drops outside or in the grounds of Blenheim Palace. But the information that Agent Sonia was picking up for the Soviets, which in some ways was probably greater than the Cambridge spies, could only have come from a very senior MI5 officer at Blenheim. And who was at Blenheim at the time? Sir Roger Hollis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So again, you start connecting all this up and it just becomes a web of who was a Soviet spy, who wasn't a Soviet spy. And that to this day, they still haven't properly exonerated. I mean, the MI5 has exonerated Sir Roger Hollis, but a lot of people still think he may have been a Soviet agent.
Yeah, I have not read up on him as much as I would like. I do have Peter Wright's book on my bookshelf. I haven't actually read it yet, but I understood that did tremendous damage to Hollis and perhaps justifiably or perhaps not, and a lot of people are still discussing and disagreeing on that to this day. It seems like even, 70 years later?
Quite. And then if you go beyond the Roger Hollis issue, then you start going into the realms of Sir Harold Wilson, British Prime Minister, and then the whole MI5, a part of MI5, a rogue part, was plotting to undermine his government. So you see one thing connects to another, and there's a almost like a domino effect on all of this.
Yeah, that's incredible, the amount of chaos that can be sown by a few recruitments at the right time and the right place many years earlier, even.
Yeah.
I mean, Deutsch, like you talked about, look at the ramifications of everything he did, and he was just one guy. I guess you could kind of pin it all to him, in a way.
So, you know, cause and effect, always at the heart of every historical episode.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, really amazing stuff, and it makes sense to me why people keep coming back to this, as you and I are right now, but it really gets your head spinning.
Yes, quite.
So, since you mentioned that they were passing along this information, how were they doing so without getting caught? Was it a lot of dead letter drops like you mentioned with Agent Sonia or something else?
Well, interestingly, it depended on the individual. Burgess preferred face-to-face meetings with his handlers, while Philby passed on the majority of his espionage material via dead drops. Yet periodically, all of the Cambridge spies met their numerous handlers, figures such as Arnold Deutsch, Theodore Marley, and Yuri Modin, in person.
Okay. Yeah, those face-to-face meetings are very dangerous, but I guess that they were able to get away with it for quite some time. Did they have any significant close calls along the way?
Well, one of the most famous is when Burgess once dropped a briefcase full of classified material all over the floor of a London pub. He managed to get it all back in the briefcase, but that was just one example. Wow. I mean, also, Burgess's drunken and reckless behaviour, as well as that of McLean, brought official attention upon them. But the idea that they were spies was utterly rejected because the logic ran that no Soviet spy would draw such attention to themselves. Also, McLean jeopardized his cover by telling his wife, who was an American citizen, the first wife, Melinda, that he was a Soviet agent. Ken Cross was interrogated by MI5 in September 1951 following the defection of Burgess and McLean. although Blunt had been partly successful in sanitising Burgess's flat after they fled, but a handwritten note from Cairncross to Burgess was eventually discovered in Burgess's flat by MI5. I mean, basically, overall, the Cambridge spy ring was always liable to be exposed because all five members knew each other. So in retrospect, it's amazing that Soviet intelligence, which prided itself on secrecy, tradecraft, and professionalism, should have recruited five men to spy for it who all knew each other intimately. There were no firewalls or cutouts between the agents, and the need-to-know principle was completely ignored. It meant that once one mole was unmasked, the rest of them would fall like dominoes.
I see. Yeah, that does seem like, in retrospect, that does seem like that was an error in judgment. I'm not sure if I would say a mistake, because clearly they were very effective at what they did, but it certainly is counter to the normal tactics that they use. So since you mentioned that Melinda was told by her husband that he was a Soviet spy, did she report that to anyone? Like, what happened with that information at that point? Did she just not believe him, maybe?
Oh, no. My understanding from the secondary literature is that she definitely believed it, but was absolutely loyal to her husband.
Wow.
And she eventually, as you know, she eventually went and joined Donald MacLean in Moscow.
Yeah, that's right. I do recall
that. So she was utterly loyal.
Okay. Wow. I know many times that the spurned spouse has been the key that has unlocked a big investigation and arrest, but not in this case, apparently.
No, quite. No, she was very loyal to them, to the point when I believe then she started to have an affair with Philby once they were in Moscow. So, and then, you know, I believe that then Donald MacLean had a second wife. But yeah.
Oh my gosh, what a odd social situation that is. I don't even know how to wrap my head around it like that. But that happening after you're already in Russia and
all very incestuous,
with your husband and risked everything.
It was just like the Cambridge spies, very incestuous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely agree. Very odd. So since you mentioned the close calls and some of the very, very serious sloppiness, why do you think that they were able to get away with this so long? I mean, were the counterintelligence personnel just thinking it couldn't possibly be these guys, or was it just very sloppy work overall? I mean, someone was supposed to be looking out for exactly this kind of thing, but it went on for years.
Well, firstly, the Cambridge spies didn't use radio, which was obviously an agent's Achilles heel, for radio transmissions could easily be detected and the messages intercepted and decoded. Also, the Cambridge spy were trusted by their employers and therefore not suspected for the vast majority of their spying careers. Their Soviet handlers used good tradecraft and were not identified, surveilled, or arrested. The weaknesses of MI5 and Special Branch during the 1930s and 1940s, particularly poor surveillance, played a critical role, as did the weaknesses of the British state and the lack of security vetting. Also, the outrageous behaviour of Burgess and MacLean helped greatly. As I said, their drunken and violent outbursts were so high profile that they provided perfect cover. Their social backgrounds also ensured they were never suspected of treachery until it was too late. And from one example, Philby's father, Harry St. John Philby, was a right-wing Arabist, former naval intelligence officer, an establishment figure. Burgess had been a naval cadet at Dartmouth and an old Etonian. Blunt had attended Marlborough Public School and was a cousin of the Queen, mother. Oh, MacLean's father had been a liberal cabinet minister, and Donald himself had attended the prestigious Gresham School. So the Cambridge spies and other Soviet moles were only ever as strong as the weaknesses of the system they were operating in. It is far easier, obviously, for a totalitarian state to spy inside a democracy than it is for the intelligence services of a democracy to spy inside a closed society, such as the USSR, one controlled by a police state.
Right. Totally agree. Yeah, that's one of the inherent weaknesses of our systems compared to the Soviets, is they always, the deck was always stacked against us in this
exactly.
game, because they could do pretty much anything that they wanted to, especially within their own borders.
It was like penetrating the other closed society, the Third Reich. During the pre-war, wartime, and post-war period, those closed totalitarian states, you know, proved very hard intelligence nuts to crack.
Mm-hmm. Before we go on, I want to let you all know about a new educational tool you're not going to want to miss. It's the Gray Man Briefing Classified. By now, I think I know my listeners pretty well, and take it from me, this briefing is exactly the news and educational reference source that you've been looking for. You'll get breaking news updates from all over the world on topics including planned protests and riots, low-intensity conflicts, natural disaster alerts, cyber attacks, supply chain disruptions, and more. You'll also get access to articles that help you build your own skills, including urban survival, home security, counter-surveillance, escape and evasion techniques, and more. And this is much more than just a newsletter in your inbox. Joining the Gray Man Briefing Classified also includes invitation-only channels on the Telegram and Signal apps for convenient real-time updates. The newsletter subscription is normally $5 per month, but if you use the code GBCSpycraft, you can save 20% each month for the life of your subscription. I'm already a member myself and have been reading and learning a lot since I first subscribed. Look it up yourself at graymanbriefing.com. That's gray with an A, graymanbriefing.com. And use the discount code GBCSpycraft to save 20% right from the start. Paul, I'm curious as well, because something I've seen on the American side in the 1940s, in particular the early to mid-1940s, was because the Soviet Union was our wartime ally, the obvious signs of recruited Soviet agents in the U.S., they were pretty much ignored or severely downplayed in a lot of ways. So was that a part of it, especially in the 40s, was that, you know, our enemy is the Axis powers, our enemy is not the Soviet Union at this time?
Well, this is it. A lot of people, as you know, were very sympathetic towards the Soviets from 41 onwards. They were seen as an ally, and they were. You know, Churchill joked in the House of Commons that if the devil invaded hell, he would at least give Satan a good reference. Although if Hitler invaded hell, he would at least give Satan a good reference. Yeah, it's forgotten now how much pro-Soviet Union, I mean, Britain in particular, and probably I think less so in the United States. But they, you know, Russia was seen as an ally who was taking on the bulk of the Wehrmacht, who was winning all these victories, who Joseph Stalin was seen as Uncle Joe. So again, you're absolutely right. It was a very conducive environment in which Soviet agents could penetrate democracies such as the United States and the United Kingdom. So again, you're right. It was all in their favor. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we learned the lesson too late, unfortunately, in that case.
Well, quite. I think, you know, in particular, I mean, the British were far more skeptical of the Soviets because we were, after 1917, the British, as you know, were extremely anti-communist.
Oh, yeah, of course.
And the interwar period is characterized by British intelligence being very much focused on the communist threat. Mm-hmm. Obviously, less so in the United States. So in some ways, you know, one could be uncharitable and say the Americans were naive or, you know, gullible. But that's unfair. It's just they were not in the same game against the Soviets as the British. So right. We were a hell of a lot more cynical, skeptical, on the alert, where the Americans had not had that experience. And Stalin's spies totally and utterly exploited that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no question. So, Paul, since you mentioned earlier that Burgess and McLean, they fled to Russia in 1951, what was the catalyst for them leaving?
Well, interestingly, principally, it was the U.S. Venona Project, which was a counterintelligence program which ran from 1943 until 1980, and which attempted to decode intercepted messages sent by the NKVD and GRU during the Second World War. And these messages sent in 1944 and 1945, particularly referring to a Soviet mole, codenamed Homer, who was operating in the British Embassy and whose pregnant wife lived in New York, allowed US intelligence in April 1951 to narrow down a list of 9 suspects to just Donald McLean. Before this happened, however, Kim Philby, who was a liaison officer between MI6 and the CIA, FBI, and National Security Agency, and who'd been indoctrinated into the Venona secret in 1949, guessed the identity of Homer and consequently got Burgess to get himself sent home in disgrace to London, where McLean was working, so as to warn McLean that he'd been unmasked. This then set in train the exfiltration of McLean and the unintended defection of Burgess on the 25th of May, 1951.
Oh, wow. What makes you say the unintended defection of...
Because Burgess was never supposed to go. Philby told Burgess, on no account are you to accompany McLean abroad? Because if you do, then it just creates even more alarm bells.
Sure, sure.
And then it would just be quicker then for British intelligence and special branch to focus their attention onto Philby, who obviously was known to know and be close to Burgess and McLean.
Yeah, I see. So what made him leave anyway, even after those explicit instructions not to?
It's a good question about the psychology of Burgess, that he wanted to make sure his friend McLean was okay, because by this time McLean was pretty much a physical and psychological wreck. He was drinking far too much. He was burned out. He was a burned out agent. Mm. And so Burgess was worried about McLean and thought, well, actually, I should accompany him to get him into Europe and then be passed down, you know, through a Soviet agent pipeline.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, I can see that through a wrench in the works.
So all these unintended consequences then, as I was saying later, then brought attention on to Philby.
Okay. Yeah, he became known as the third man for a while, even though we now know, of course, that there were more than three, right?
Exactly. Yes. But that was all. But the exfiltration on the 25th of May 1951 then sets in train all the suspicions and all the fingers and all eyes then are on Philby.
Okay, I see. So since you call it an exfiltration, does that mean that the Soviets had a whole plan to transport them safely, you know, through Europe, something like that? Or, I mean, they didn't just flee on their own?
Well, actually, on the night of the 25th of May, Burgess and McLean escaped from London, travelled down to Southampton docks, and then boarded a cross-channel ferry destined for St. Malo. Although their exact movements are still shrouded in secrecy, we do know that they were passed down a Soviet agent pipeline through Western Europe until they resurfaced behind the Iron Curtain in Moscow. Interestingly, it would be another 5 years, however, until the Soviets admitted that the two traitors were now living in the Soviet Union. But as I said, their exact movements are still shrouded in secrecy, and the Soviets weren't going to give away their pipeline and the people operating that pipeline.
Oh, sure. Yeah, that's incredibly valuable to keep in place afterwards.
Exactly.
So how did Philby weather the storm? Because he was being accused of things that he absolutely had done at that point, wasn't he?
Well, yeah. I mean, the thing is about the atmosphere that was going on in the upper echelons of the UK government and then MI6. I mean, it was one of shock, denial, uncertainty, paranoia, and then later of betrayal. I think many of those who'd known the Cambridge Five and had worked with them were shell-shocked when they discovered that they had been spying for the Russians. Yet there were some who had always suspected Philby. One former wartime MI6 officer told me during an interview that, ironically, Philby's tradecraft was pretty poor. When in MI6 headquarters, he used to lean over typists and look at what they were typing. Moreover, he used to give those female secretaries whom he wished to extract information from single red roses. So nevertheless, a few senior SIS officers knew he was a communist and were actually highly suspicious of him. They actually called him a bloody commie. So interestingly, the distinguished historian Hugh Trevor-Ober, who worked for wartime SIS, was also another one who did not trust Philby and did not succumb to his charms. Yet incredibly, nothing was done about these suspicions surrounding Philby until McLean and Burgess defected. Whether this was due to cognitive dissonance, groupthink, the ostrich effect, or mirror imaging on the part of British intelligence, we shall never really know. Yet British intelligence did indeed fall into these psychological traps regarding the Cambridge Five.
Amazing stuff. And it makes for a great case study afterwards, but it certainly makes you think, you know, what in the world were they thinking at that time? Because I've seen that very famous clip of Philby answering questions from reporters at the time and being described as the third man. And he just weathered that storm against all odds.
Yeah, people in Whitehall, people particularly in the British secret state who knew these people, who socialized with them, who worked alongside them, who trusted them, they just could not get their heads around the fact that they'd been betrayed and they'd been working for the Soviets all that time.
Yeah, amazing stuff. So what was it that ultimately led Philby to leave the country and join Burgess and McLean? Was there something else from Venona transcripts or something else entirely?
Well, I mean, first of all, following the defection of Burgess and McLean, he Heath Philby was forced to resign from MI6, owing obviously to his connections to the two men.
Okay.
He immediately came under intense suspicion and was interrogated several times by MI5 during the early 1950s. Yet in 1955, he was publicly exonerated by the then Foreign Secretary, Harold Macmillan, which allowed him to rejoin MI6 and work under journalistic cover in Beirut until his own defection to Russia in January 1963. I mean, the British establishment and secret state, as I said, they couldn't bear the embarrassment. There's one thing that the Whitehall and Westminster, the British establishment, can't stand, and that's embarrassment. So by allowing Philby to go to Beirut without surveilling him whilst he was there, I suspect that SIS and the secret state were hoping that he would defect and save them the embarrassment of a court case at the Old Bailey.
Oh, wow. Wow. Okay, interesting.
Yeah, it's the kind of tidy-minded, bureaucratic mentality of those who worked in Whitehall and Westminster that, you know, if Philby were brought to trial, it would just open up so many other cans of worms. And also, it would have to be done in camera because of all the secrets inside Philby's head. So what better just to allow him to slide away across the Iron Curtain and not be a problem for the British anymore?
Yeah, yeah. Not be a problem for these specific individuals either, it sounds like. That's a very unusual kind of calculus. And I do understand it to a certain extent, but it's amazing that they decide it's just, this guy has done incredible damage to it, and we should just essentially let him get away with it.
Oh, it's extremely shabby. But then, you know, what government hasn't done something shabby in its time? You know, we'd all like to think they play by the rules and are all play with a straight bat. But, you know, it was best that these people just disappeared and that then MI5, MI6 and whoever else could then behind closed door start trying to do a damage assessment on what these people had done, who they'd recruited, you know, what information they passed on. And as I said, a damage limitation, a damage assessment.
Yeah, I can see some points in the favor of that if I'm looking at it very critically. Like, if he defects, he immediately loses his access, so he won't be able to pass on anything new from that day forward. And he will also never be able to deny in any shape, you know, way, shape or form that he was a Soviet agent all along. So in certain sense, that does make sense to me.
And also in Britain, I think in the United States, you've always historically been a lot hotter on prosecuting traitors. But there's simply in the UK under English law, there simply wasn't enough evidence to convict the Cambridge Five. So incredibly, treachery was very hard to prove, hence the lack of prosecutions of those who had spied for Stalin from the 1930s to the 1950s. I think a lot of people say this, it's a conspiracy to protect their own and, you know, all of this. Well, as I said, first embarrassment, but also under English law, it's extremely difficult. So even if you had them all arrested, all incarcerated, to then prove that they had actually been traitors would have been very, very difficult. It's like the example of Cairncross. I mean, he was interrogated by MI5 in 1951 and 1952, but he was never charged, even though he admitted to MI5 in 1964 that he had spied for Russia. And the same with Blunt, when he's interrogated over and over and over again. He admits that he'd spied to the Russians, but then he's given immunity from prosecution. And this is what makes Mrs. Thatcher wild in 1979 when she gets up. November 1979, she gets up in the House of Commons and tells the world that Sir Anthony Blunt had spied for the Soviets, because she could not get her head around the fact that they had been given immunity from prosecution and had been allowed to then, as with Blunt, be the surveyor of the Queen's pictures.
I can understand why she would be very, very, very upset about that.
Yeah, it'd be the equivalent of someone in the United States being unmasked as a top-level Soviet agent and then being allowed to then work in the White House in a sinecure.
Hard to imagine, but yeah.
Your country, luckily, would never tolerate that.
Right. certainly hope not. I have to try and put myself in the shoes of some people. Back in 1951, you know, I'm speculating that there were a few people who were totally convinced that Philby was indeed the third man, and yet he didn't actually leave until 63. He didn't defect till 63. So for 12 years, he was walking around a free man. And then for, what, 7 years, I think, he was back in MI6. I bet that must have just, they must have been just grinding their teeth, you know, seeing him walking around totally convinced that he was a traitor. And all along, they were correct.
Well, obviously, a lot of this was compartmentalized. Mm-hmm. Only a few, you know, a very select few people, you know, the need to know principle there. But as I said, no one else, because I was lucky enough to interview a former senior MI6 officer who knew, you know, he worked in headquarters SIS when Philby was there. Saw him doing all these weird things like, you know, leaning over typists and giving them roses, and other senior SIS officers were actually saying, this guy's a communist, we don't trust him, what's he doing here? But then so much ink has been spilt by espionage writers, historians, on why Sir Stuart Mingus in particular, the head of MI6, allowed that to carry on, and why other senior SIS officers didn't get Philby moved out, just even under suspicion. These are the mysteries that are still classified,
right?
Or they're either classified or we will never know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are so many open questions, because I touch on a lot of subjects in this realm, and there's so many questions that haven't been answered 50, 60, 70 years later, and probably never will be. And it's endlessly frustrating, but it's endlessly intriguing as well.
Well, the thing is about intelligence history is that a lot of people think that all these files are locked away, you know, and eventually one day they might be released. Well, the depressing truth is a lot of the files have been weeded and burned over the decades. And also what people forget about espionage, and I was told this by this former senior SIS officer, and he said, you've got to remember that most of our work was done face-to-face, verbally, on the telephone. And therefore, that record, those words, went into the ether and will never be brought back again. You can't reconstruct the past, because this stuff was, a lot of it was never written down. It was people passing each other in the corridor, or sitting in an office talking, or using the telephone. So unfortunately, you know, the jigsaw puzzle, which is the Cambridge spies, there are going to be large pieces, many pieces of the jigsaw that we will never have.
Yes, that's very unfortunate. Actually, that reminds me of something. A few months ago, I interviewed an author named Rory Cormack. I'm not sure if you're familiar with him. He wrote A History of MI6. And I do recall from his book that there is one operation that he talked about very briefly, but the only written record of it is a single handwritten word, I think, or a single handwritten sentence on a note, like on the minutes of a meeting. There's like a question that somebody wrote down on the minutes of the meeting, and that's the only record that's been found of this operation. So, you know, God knows how much history has been lost, unfortunately.
Well, don't forget, you know, it was their tradecraft. It was the need-to-know principle.
Right.
Things were said between individuals that should never reach other people's ears. So I think, again, people need, you know, if they're interested in reading up about intelligence history, they must bear in mind that, again, a lot of this was done face-to-face on the telephone, never committed to paper. Done in gentlemen's clubs and elsewhere, and it's lost. It's gone to the grave with the people who uttered those words.
Yeah, it's unfortunate for the historians, you know, but very fortunate for them, I suppose. So, yeah. Paul, what happened once that Burgess and McLean and Philby, once they arrived in the USSR, how were they actually treated by that country?
Well, there is, unsurprisingly, a pecking order in the secret world. In Britain, there used to be the sort of snobbery and sort of elitism, like, you know, a case officer versus an analyst. And the case officer was always regarded as more, you know, special than the analyst. Well, in terms of secret intelligence services, will deny this vehemently. And you'll probably have people on here commenting, saying that this Paul Winter, he doesn't know what he's talking about. But I've actually heard former spooks talk about former agents in a very disparaging way. And all intelligence services, whether people like it or not, do treat their agents with a varying degrees of deep-seated scorn. Because in the final analysis, moles are traitors to their own countries and are perceived as such. You know, they're useful up to a point. And don't get me wrong, there have been some extremely good field officers, case officers, who've been the exception to the rule. But in my experience, a lot of these people are actually, you know, they're treated quite scornfully behind their backs, and you know, by history. And the Soviets were no different. They regarded Philby, MacLean and Burgess the same and treated them with a Stalinist suspicion, contempt and indifference. I mean, all three were placed under constant surveillance by Soviet authorities. Hmm. While Philby lectured for a while at the KGB spy school and wrote his notorious book, My Secret War, he soon became stale, drinking, womanizing, and resting on his own perception of himself as a master spy and colonel in the KGB. I mean, he eventually died in 1988. But again, he regarded himself as this great savior of the Soviet Union, when in fact the KGB were very suspicious of him and Burgess and MacLean. I mean, interestingly, Burgess never learned Russian or assimilated. He had some Russian boyfriends, missed Britain terribly, and ultimately he drank himself to death, dying in 1963. I mean, MacLean, interestingly, was the only one who learned Russian and plugged in to Soviet intellectual and political life. He was, moreover, the only one who remained an ideologue to the end of his life. Yet he, too, was a heavy drinker, dying of cancer in 1983. So overall, they were treated as useful idiots by the Soviets. Mm. Ultimately, Philby, Burgess and MacLean embarrassed the US and UK and their intelligence agencies, but provided extremely good propaganda for the Soviet bloc. But in terms of their being in behind the Iron Curtain in the Soviet Union, their lives were not that fruitful, as I said, apart from MacLean, who did try.
Yeah, I have to imagine that there was a huge amount of regret at various times for all three of those guys if they, you know, escaped the possibility of prison in the UK and then found themselves in another form of prison once they arrived and settled in.
Yeah. I've always thought that the two most dangerous figures out of the Cambridge Five were Philby and Blunt. They, as I said, they were the linchpins, and they were very dangerous. They knew exactly what they were doing. They were excellent at manipulating people and getting what they wanted. I've always felt that MacLean and Burgess were sort of, they were, really were the useful idiots. Mm-hmm. Cairncross is different because he was very intellectually arrogant, but had a huge social inferiority chip on his shoulder, and was, I would say, naive up to a point, but I would say he was the third most dangerous out of the five. But no doubt that Philby and Blunt were the most dangerous and the ones that did the most damage.
Yeah, certainly. And it's a story that we continue to go back to again and again. So, Paul, what were the changes to the kind of British security hierarchy and counterintelligence after all of this? I mean, it played out very slowly over a period of years, of course, but did they come to their senses in any respect and decide to, you know, take certain things more seriously after this?
Definitely. For one, positive vetting was introduced in the early 1950s. So recruits into the British secret world, although civil servants working in sensitive areas of UK defence, now had to be screened and security cleared where they weren't before. Also, recruitment became a little more meritocratic. There was a wider pool of talent admitted into the British secret state. The old boy network from which four of the five Cambridge spies were recruited was not as relied upon, luckily, as much as it had been in the past. MI5 also became a lot more vigilant regarding Soviet communist espionage within the UK government itself. So everything, as you can imagine and appreciate, was tightened up. Amateurism was out, and a more professional approach to counterintelligence and security was in.
Okay, that's good to hear. And I know it certainly wasn't the end of all problems, but it sounds like a lot of important lessons were learned along the way.
Yeah, definitely. The lessons were identified and actually learned for once.
Yeah. So you mentioned very early on in our discussion the possibility that there were more than five. Were there others who were approached and turned down, or were there some that were recruited but never detected, you think?
Well, interestingly, there was a chap called Walter Bell, who was a former SIS and MI5 officer, and his biography has just been published by Jimmy Burns, who used to be the security and intelligence correspondent for the Financial Times. And it's a story that nobody knew about, and Jimmy Burns had access to Bell's archive. And what came out was that during the Second World War, Burgess in particular tried to recruit Bell and took him on a wild pub crawl across London, ostensibly admiring the places that Karl Marx had visited. But it was Burgess basically trying out Bell, who was left-leaning, but was not interested in being a Soviet agent. Philby also eyed up Bell, but eventually wrote to his Soviet handlers that Bell was not to be turned. But apart from that, I mean, aside from the Magnificent Five and the Bell case, there were Paddy Costello, another attendee of Trinity College, Cambridge, who was a Communist Party member and a Soviet agent. Leo Long, yet another member of Trinity College, Cambridge, and an apostle, a Communist Party card holder and a senior wartime intelligence officer within British military intelligence, who reported directly to Blunt. And Cedric Belfrage, a Cambridge-educated Soviet agent who reported to Philby. There were also James Klugman, again Trinity College, Cambridge, and an officer in SOE, the Special Operations Executive. Notably, Klugman is credited with converting MacLean, Burgess and Blunt to communism and also introducing Cairncross to Arnold Deutsch in 1937. Oh, another was Michael Strait. Predictably, he attended Trinity College, Cambridge, was recruited by Blunt, and was yet another member of the Apostles. In 1963, interestingly, Strait told US authorities during a background check for government work that Blunt had been a recruiter at Cambridge. Consequently, MI5 was tipped off about Blunt and thereafter sought a confession from him. So you can see that the epicenter of Soviet intelligence, recruiting, and networking and operating in Cambridge is Trinity College, Cambridge. Mm. And interestingly, when I was at Cambridge, I always used to refer to that college as the Traitor's College, because no other single college had so many Soviet agents.
My gosh, what a nest of spies that place was.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And interestingly, next door to Trinity College, Cambridge, is St. John's College, Cambridge, where they were all working for our side.
So that part is fine. Yeah.
Within a few yards, you had Moscow's, you know, Stalin's Englishmen and Scotsmen working there. And in St. John's, they were all worked for British intelligence on our side.
Amazing. Amazing. What a story. So, Paul, after all this time, I think we've talked about how some things will probably never be known. But do you think there might still be any big revelations coming at this point? Or is everything that we're ever going to learn been learned already?
Well, the two KGB defectors, Oleg Gordievsky and Vasily Matrokhin, as you know, having had access to the KGB files, revealed much of what we know about the Cambridge Five. I mean, this information was written up by my former Cambridge doctoral supervisor, Professor Christopher Andrew, in his 1990 book, Inside the KGB, also in volume one of the Matrokhin files archive, as well as in the authorized history of MI5 that came out. Yuri Modin, one of the Cambridge Five's KGB handlers, also revealed a lot of detail about this spy ring in his book, My Five Cambridge Friends. MI5, as you know, has also released to the UK National Archives a considerable number of files on the Cambridge Five and other Soviet agents. It is more than likely that they still possess material on this spy network, but if and when they will release it to the public is anyone's guess. Also, SIS had their official history published in 2010, which went from 1909 to 1949. But obviously, there's a suspicion that they obviously have material on Philby in particular, which they do not want to release. So, as I said to you before, I think there's a case of intelligence material that's still classified in the UK. There's obviously the KGB archives that obviously have masses of material, which I don't think anyone's ever going to see, have access to. And also what I said earlier about the fact that there are pieces of the jigsaw which we will never, ever obtain.
Yeah, that's unfortunate. That really is a sad state of affairs for historians like us. Anyway, but it is nevertheless, it's just endlessly intriguing, honestly. So it keeps me coming back, that's for sure.
But as I said earlier on about the Walter Bell case, that was an archive that no one knew existed. So the optimist in me hopes that there are other intelligence archives, private archives out there that hopefully, you know, historians might have access to, and they might shed some more light as the Walter Bell archive shed light on Burgess and MacLean and Philby.
Yeah, yeah. Things do tend to pop up in unexpected places once in a while. I know. I think I spoke to someone. It might have been Giles Milton I interviewed a while back, and he said a lot of stuff had been declassified by the Indian government from many years before, and it was stuff left over from British time there. But yep. Some interesting MI6 material had come out of there, and then I did an episode last year, I think, that there was a wartime American private intelligence organization called the Pond, and most of our knowledge of that organization comes from some documents found in a house in the 1990s. So we can still kind of hold out hope that something else will appear one day.
Well, parallel, we call them parallel archives. It's that you're right. People have to think laterally and think where, sort of SIS, MI5, GCHQ material might lay. I mean, the Norwegians actually had a lot of SIS material from the Second World War, and a former Foreign Office operative went up to Oslo or wherever they were stashed and accessed SIS material that we in this country don't have access to, and wrote a pretty impressive book on that. So, these parallel archives are out there. They just need to be found and tapped.
Yes, yes. Hopefully one day we'll have a little bit more insight.
Definitely.
So, Paul, thank you. This has been a wonderful conversation, and this is an endlessly fascinating story for sure. I'm curious for you personally, what are you up to these days? Are you working on another book right now or teaching courses or something?
Well, I've recently returned to my Cambridge PhD thesis, which was entitled Fathoming the Führer, British Intelligence, Adolf Hitler and the German High Command, 1939 to 1945. I mean, in essence, it's about the age-old necessity of knowing one's enemy and discerning future strategic and operational intentions. I will be publishing this book with the excellent Chiselbury Publishing, who are on Instagram, who published Jimmy Burns' book on Walter Bell. And Chiselbury is a new independent publisher who's just, as I said, released that fantastic book, which I also recently reviewed for the Times Literary Supplement. So, yeah, I'm working for Chiselbury, and hopefully in a year or two, I will have this book out on how British intelligence tried to fathom Hitler and the German High Command.
Okay, fantastic. I look forward to that. And I'm going to have to read that Walter Bell book as well. I know you mentioned it before, and it sounds very intriguing.
Yeah, it's a page-turner.
Great. Okay, well, thank you so much. Paul, is there anywhere that people can connect with you online if they want to look you up after this? You have social media pages, anything like that?
Yes, people can follow me on Instagram. I'm at Dr. Paul Winter. I've written for The Critic magazine as well. And I'm intending to do some work on Substack, hopefully this year. Also, my books, Defeating Hitler, D-Day Documents, and First In, Last Out, are available on Amazon as well.
Okay, fantastic. Well, thank you so much, Paul. This has been a great talk. I appreciate your time.
No, thank you very much.
Of course, anytime.
Take care. Pleasure. Thank you. Bye-bye.
If you're interested in more of Spycraft 101, look for my page on Instagram at Spycraft101. You can also find more great articles on my website, spycraft101.com. Thank you all for listening, and I hope you'll stick around because there's lots more to come.
Disclaimer. This podcast is for entertainment purposes only. The stories and statements expressed herein are experiences and opinions. They may not reflect the views of the host or the production studio. It's okay if you disagree with our content. No piece of media is right for everyone. If you love Spycraft 101, please check us out online, on Instagram, on YouTube, and especially on Patreon. Thank you for listening.